We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 71. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Dr. Michelle Koons from the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
Let's dig a little deeper. Dr. Michelle Koons is the curator of archaeology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. She studies ancient complex societies and is especially interested in ancient political dynamics, social networks, and how people of the past interacted with their environment. In her research, Dr. Koons uses different geophysical methods and remote sensing tools, as well as traditional archaeological techniques like excavation and pedestrian survey. She also specializes in ceramic analysis and radiocarbon dating. Michelle has conducted archaeological research throughout the United States, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, and China. Michelle curates the archaeological collections at the DMNS from Latin America, North America, and Egypt.
All right, everyone. Well, welcome to the show. Today, we are going to be talking with Michelle Koons, and we are just going to have a fun talk today about how you become a curator of archaeology and what you do and some of the really neat public outreach and public archaeology projects that Michelle has been doing and the museum has been working on. Welcome to the show, Michelle. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, Michelle and I have worked kind of adjacent and on similar projects and run into each other a bunch since I've done all this work with the University of Denver and the Denver Amachi project. So it's really exciting for me to finally get a chance to sit down and interview her and talk to you on the show. So
yeah, definitely.
We're really happy to have you here.
Excited too, because yeah, we've sort of been sort of ships passing in the night many ways.
Yeah, no, we really have. And I was thinking about it today and I realized I think you might be the first kind of museum affiliated person that we've had on the show.
Great. Yeah, well, I'm excited to participate in that capacity.
Yeah. So I realized that one of the things that I kind of wanted to talk to you about just to start this off is, you know, as a curator of archaeology and as an archaeologist who works in a museum, can you tell us a little bit about what that job really encompasses in the roles? Because when people visit museums, you know, they see what a couple percentage of the collection on display. And you don't really get a sense of all of the logistics and things that go on in the back rooms behind all those closed doors.
Sure. Yeah. So it's, I believe on average, and it's about 1% of the collection is actually out on display. And we at the DMNS and most museums have all kinds of things happening behind closed doors. And so it is pretty exciting to get to, see what that's like and to make it happen, so to speak.
Yeah. So as a curator of archaeology, are you just sort of supervising people watching the collections? Are you, what does it kind of encompass?
What do I do? Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, what don't you do? Maybe the better question is, what don't you do?
That is probably the more accurate question, or appropriate question, I should say. But yeah, so a curator is really, you know, so many different museums have curators, and there's really no one definition. And from institution to institution, that role is going to vary. And it can vary very significantly. Here at the Denver Museum, which is a major natural history museum. So we're kind of similar to museum. We're actually the fourth largest in the country. So we're similar to like the Field Museum, the Smithsonian, and have that sort of curator structure. My job is to do original research. So I have various research projects that I'm working on, just like any academic would. I curate specific collections. And so I'm in charge of the Latin American collection, a good portion of our North American Persian collection and also our Egyptian collection. And so that means that I do research on parts of those collections, or I facilitate research. So I get people in, like experts in different subjects, to come in and see what we have so that we can make it more accessible. We are currently moving our archaeology collection from one place in the building, and we built a new facility a couple years ago. And so we're moving into that right now, and everything's getting a new box and a new house, and it's going to be really beautiful when it's all there. And so just facilitating that work is something I'm involved in. And another big part of my job is the outreach and just getting people excited about archaeology and what that means in the museum.
Yeah. So that's actually part of the reason we invited Michelle to be on the show. Is she gave a phenomenal talk at our annual conference about some of the work that you've been doing at Magic Mountain, which is a prehistoric site outside of the Denver region, and kind of the logistics of that. And it was absolutely wonderful. And so we wanted to have you on to talk about that and talk about this idea of engaging people with archaeological research and how you went about it. And yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about why the museum does this public outreach?
Sure. So actually, when I started here at the museum, about even in my job talk about 6 years ago now, I can't believe that, I said that one of my goals was to have a public archaeology project, because this institution particularly we're really well known for our dinosaur work and all the work that we do in paleontology. And it's pretty ingrained into like the culture of this place, and as well as Denver too. Everybody knows about the dinosaur footprints that are just down the road. And I was like, wow, there's such an opportunity for people to get engaged with archaeology and what's right in our backyard. Like, so many people are just unfamiliar that even exists. When you say archaeology in Colorado, most people are thinking, oh, Mesa Verde, there's nothing right here in Denver. And so I was really passionate about doing this and just bringing that passion, because, you know, we love archaeology and we know that the public loves archaeology, but they don't necessarily have as many avenues to get engaged in it as I think us as professionals would like for them to have to be exposed to it. And being in a public museum, or a museum that is so public facing, it was just a really great opportunity to be able to engage a lot of people in various kinds of ways, because we just have that capacity with our media relations and also with our programming department, where they could get involved and help us to really craft something that would be successful. So I was really excited to be able to get this project off the ground at the site of Magic Mountain, which is a hunter-gatherer site that was occupied. We've now, in our research, pushed the years back to about 9,000 years ago, up to about 1,000 years ago, and really get people of all different walks of life out there to experience what life would have been like back in the past, but also just the whole science and process of archaeology.
So can you just tell us a little bit about what the site of Magic Mountain is? So it's obviously a prehistoric site. It's 9,000 years old, but what's a little bit about the history of it? I mean, why did you choose Magic Mountain as a site?
I
mean, there's all of these hidden sites when you're walking around Colorado. So why this one? What's so special or interesting?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of different reasons we chose this particular site. And it kind of is this perfect storm of reasons why. The site was originally, so it's a hunter-gatherer campground, and in our excavations and in previous excavations that happened at the site, we've found fire pits and evidence of people living on this. It's on the edge of a creek bed, right at the base of one of the major access points that goes up into the mountains. It was used as this canyon, or it's a gulch, was used as a major road for wagon trains or wagons going up to the Central City Black Hawk area, which is where a lot of the gold rush was happening in Colorado. And so it's a really prominent route that would have been used in the past, as well as even today, people are always biking and hiking right there. And so the site itself is in a really great location for it to where people could have lived for a really long time. But it's also a really great location for today, because it's right at this trailhead. There are bathrooms, there's a very large parking lot, and it's very easy to get a lot of people in and to construct a tour of the area that's like 45 minutes. And it just had the logistics were perfect for just getting people to see it and to be exposed to it. So, but there's also been a very long history of the Denver Museum, which used to be the Colorado Museum of Natural History, their involvement with the archaeology of the site. And we have many collections from there that have been collected going back into the 1930s. And so just that continuity of that history made it just was kind of the perfect storm of places to bring the public in to explore. Not only is it's also one of the biggest and most important sites in this region as well.
So can you explain a little bit why it's one of these big important sites?
Sure. I think a lot of it has to do with that access I was talking about, the ability to get into the mountains really easily. You also have fantastic views of the plains. It's located right on the bank of a stream, but there's also a natural spring right there. So people could have lived there really for long periods of time. Some of our research questions are questioning if people were using this only seasonally or if they were there more continuously. There's this idea that people were mobile hunter-gatherers in this region, and they would just go to certain areas for example, like the winter. But we're questioning that and saying, well, maybe they were here for more like a couple years in a row rather than just over winter months. Another reason it's in such a great location has to do a lot with the topography of this area. It's right up against the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, so directly at the base of the foothills. But it's also in what is called the Hogback Valley. So there's this geological formation where it creates sort of this little valley in the Golden area that is climatically warmer than anything to the east on the plains or also up in the mountains. And so you find really the majority of archaeological sites in the region in this Hogback Valley because of that it has that protection. And so this site is located right in this Hogback Valley. It has water, and it was just a very, very large site. There's been thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of objects that have been found there going back into the 30s when they were first recorded.
Well, I suppose that would lead into a conversation about the curation problem in museums, but that might be a conversation for another episode.
Yes.
I'm wondering, you know, this is called a community archaeology project. What sorts of things can the community really get into with this project? You mentioned tours, but are there excavations or surveys or things like that volunteers can get on and learn a little bit about the archaeological process?
Yeah, so the way that we've run it is that we had tours while we were out there excavating. We had tours every half an hour. So we had volunteers who actually were our tour guides and gave those tours. We also, the entire site was excavated by volunteers. So we had about 70 volunteers doing the excavations. And these were everybody from undergrads who had never had any experience, who were excited about archaeology, to retired professionals, and kind of just ran the whole gamut. And we would train them and had a schedule so that more experienced people could help train some of the less experienced people. We also did youth programming at the site. And so we had Boys and Girls Club out there and other youth groups from the Denver area that we bussed in, and we provided them with lunches and just tried to give them a taste of what archaeology was like. And we have a program here at the museum called Teen Science Scholars. And we had 14 teenagers, high school students, out there with us the entire time. So it was very, very busy over the 2 years that we were out there, 2017 and 2018. We really ran for the project. The museum partnered with Paleocultural Research Group, which is a nonprofit that is located in Colorado, and they do a lot of volunteer-based archaeology projects. And so they really helped us with it was a true partnership where they really helped us with the training of the volunteers, but also also conducting the science of the archaeology. And then the museum was able to really contribute with our, like I was saying earlier, with our program staff and our project management to be able to kind of make it all, pull it off the ground. And so it was just a lot of orchestration involved.
Nice. You know, I'm a proponent of huge proponent of digital archaeology, as people who listen to my Archaeotech podcast know. With such a massive amount of material coming in, what sorts of and this can be a short answer too. It's, we're hitting the end of the segment, because I'm just curious, what sorts of recording methods are you guys using to really catalog all this stuff and hopefully not get overwhelmed?
Yeah. Well, so fortunately within our excavations in the last few years, we haven't had incredible amounts of material. I would say probably about a total of maybe 13,000 objects, but this is also lots and lots of debitage. And so it's hundreds of thousands of things have been found there, but we were not necessarily bringing in that much. We actually do mostly because of the sheer amount of volunteers, and I'm a big fan of using, you know, digital methods for recording, but because of just the sheer amount of volunteers and the inability to have like tablets for everybody, we do pretty much paper recording. Mm-hmm. What's been pretty nice, though, is that we were able to devise cataloging systems that work with the museum curation system, which is so often not the case because most archaeologists are not necessarily working directly with museums, and then numbers get all changed and it gets a little messy. But we're able to kind of go right from the field right into the museum because we have this compatible system and are able to work with, we have volunteers and I have a few interns right now working with me, just getting cataloging and working through the photography of all that so we can just like immediately get it up online. So we're trying to just, you know, make it as fast as possible with that, getting into the curation, which is is a bonus of working at a museum, I suppose.
Nice. All right. Well, I think on that note, we'll take it to our first break and come back and continue this conversation with Dr. Michelle Koons. Back in a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right. Welcome back to episode 71 with Dr. Michelle Koons. And we are talking about museums and sites in the Magic Mountain Community Archaeology Project. I want to step back for a second, Michelle, and ask you about getting the job at the museum. You said you've been there for 6 years. I know in archaeology, a lot of times we just kind of take jobs that come up because, you know, work. did you always want to work in a museum, or did this just kind of fall in your lap and now you've been here for so long and you like it? I mean, how'd that come about?
It's actually a little bit of both. I was fortunate. I love museums. I always have. I've always been just a passion of mine. And so while I was at grad school, both at when I was doing my master's at the University of Denver, and even before that, I was always volunteering in museums or working in various jobs. jobs in museums, like everything from museum education to helping catalog different objects. When I got to grad school for my PhD, I was working in the Peabody Museum throughout a lot of the time I was there. And while I was writing my dissertation, I got really bored of just being by myself. So I volunteered at the Boston Museum of Science and was like an on the floor volunteer just for something fun to do. And this job came up. Well, I started as a postdoc here. And when I was interviewing for that postdoc, not only did I have, was just finishing my PhD in archaeology, I had had all of this museum experience throughout my career. So it just kind of was like, oh, it made sense. And I had no idea. It was my dream job, and I just didn't really know that it existed. And when I got here, I just absolutely loved it. And while I was here, fortunately for me, one of the curators left and they had to hire another curator. And so I felt like I was on a year-long interview because I was like, oh my gosh, I really, really want this job. I can't mess up. And so I was very lucky and fortunate to get the permanent job about a year later.
Nice. Is this the kind of thing you could see yourself just doing as continuing the rest of your career? Or do you have other ambitions and things you want to do?
I love this job. Nice. I just think it's a dream job. It's almost 7 years I've been here, and including the postdoc position. And I mean, there's constantly new and exciting things and new challenges and opportunities. And I get to do things that I never thought in a million years I would do. Like, for example, I have a book coming out in the spring on Egyptian mummies, which is totally not my background research, but so it's just been so fun to be able to do exactly what I love in a way that in a place that I really, really love. So yeah, I don't plan on going anywhere as long as they'll keep me.
Yeah. Nice. Well, maybe let's get back to Magic Mountain a little bit. How did this affiliation between Magic Mountain and the museum start? It might be a little before your time, I'm assuming, but do you know the history of how that got going?
I do. So there's actually the first mention of the site of Magic Mountain, which was not called that at the time. It was called the Apex site, came from actually the Smithsonian Magazine in the 1870s. There was some entry on how this was just a treasure trove of artifacts, like in this one particular area. And people knew about the site because it was right near this mining supply town for where the wagons would go up into the mountains to supply the camps. But it was in the 1930s when actually volunteers and museum affiliated folks were out there in the area, and they picked up some artifacts and they brought them to Colorado Natural History Museum at the time. And that's when they first entered into the collection. It was right when the archaeology department was formed at this institution. And that really sparked the interest of two museum affiliated archaeologists in the 1940s to go out there and do some excavations. And it wasn't really up to what our snuff would be today, up to par, but we have those artifacts here from the 1940s. But that research then it prompted Cynthia Irwin Williams, who went on to have quite a career in archaeology. But she was locally from Denver and was hanging out at the museum all the time, and she when she was a kid, and she eventually went on to Harvard to do her dissertation and did her dissertation on the site of Magic Mountain and really defined archaeology on the Front Range with this site. And still even terms we use of like projectile point typology comes from her work there and what she did. And her work was published through the museum, although the collections, her collections are at Harvard. But then there was another gap in time in the 1990s. There was another excavation at the site trying to just recheck and see how her work was holding up over those 30 years and advances in technology. And those collections are here at DMNS. And so we have quite a bit of materials and just long-term association with working at Magic Mountain. I should say it got its name in the 1950s when Irwin Williams was out there, because at the time there was an amusement park that owned the property. It was a failed miserably amusement park. It was in operation for like a season. It was the vice president of Disney World actually started it. And it was called Magic Mountain at the time. And that's how the site ended up with the kind of fun name.
Yeah. Wow. I never would have put that together. But for some reason, that totally makes sense, though.
Yeah.
Nice. What other outreach projects does the museum have? I mean, museums are kind of all about outreach, right? It's the total bag of the museum to put things out there in the public for people to learn from. So what are the types of outreach programs do you guys have, and what's your focus on that?
Oh man, we're just constantly doing outreach in all of our different departments. So like I was saying, our paleontology is incredibly active, and they have, just a couple weeks ago, another dinosaur was discovered in the construction in someone's backyard. And so, you know, all hands on deck type stuff. But I mean, we're constantly doing just programs with kids. Like right now, I can't even walk outside in the museum because it's summer camp season. tons of children, but we do, you know, tons of behind the scenes tours, lots of, which is really fun because people have no idea oftentimes that we have so many things back there. We do lots and lots of lectures, and I'll be given a topic and be like, hey, learn about this and do a planetarium show on like Aztec cosmology. And I'm like, okay. So we just do all kinds of, you know, it really is. You if you can dream it, we'll pull something together.
Nice.
So Michelle, how did you get so interested in museum outreach? I mean, you've said you just love museums and you've done docenting and education work, but you know, what kind of drew you to this part of it?
Well, I think it is my passion for archaeology. I love it. You know, I was that kid that was just couldn't get enough of learning about like the past and these just ancient cultures. And I also recognize that there are not that many real opportunities for kids to be engaged, kids, but even lifelong learners to be engaged with archaeology, because you know, we are so academic or in CRM industry, and we just don't have that as a discipline. I feel like we're getting much, much, much better, I think, through over the years. But I just would love to be able to share this passion more and in ways that are easily accessible for people, that they don't have to really search it out. It's like a big museum that's right there. It's like, hey, we want to give this to you. And so, I think it just came from, many years of sort of being also frustrated with my own little tiny project that I know nobody, maybe three people read my dissertation, you know? So it's like, how we can do better than that? We can do a lot better. Nice. Because it's really cool stuff, right? So,
I feel like every archaeologist who does public outreach ends up doing it because we are so fascinated and excited that we need this outlet for sort of all of our excess enthusiasm about our own research.
It's so true. Right.
And the next thing we know, we've got like, yeah.
It's true. But, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding that people, they do like it. They are hungry for it. And so, yes, it is. It does definitely fulfill a selfish need. And I totally agree with you. But it is this. I don't think it's not like just yelling at a wall. People do want to hear about it. They are excited and they're hungry for it. And so it's like it is a definitely if you build it, they will come kind of phenomena.
I'm curious, as a, you know, as a researcher, somebody who's, you know, done dissertation work, like you mentioned, and things like that, do you get much of a chance working in the museum setting to really ask your own questions, maybe do your own research, find funding for it, and do it under the auspices of the museum, like you would a university or something like that? Or is it more processing and dealing with things that are coming into the museum and existing collections?
It's both, actually. And so one of big parts of my job is this original research component. And so I have a project in the Gila National Forest. I just got back about 2 weeks ago. We're excavating a great kiva. I've been working there for about 6 years doing survey and, you know, trying to understand the landscapes of the Mogollon Highlands. I also starting a new project. I'll leave in a week and I go to Peru for a couple weeks and starting a new project there. That's where I did my dissertation research. And so again, I did my dissertation on Moche. And so we're looking at Moche on the North Coast. And so in many ways, it's actually great because I have three major research projects going right now that I get to do field work for. But then I also do these opportunistic research projects like the Egyptian mummies project that we just CT scanned and did a whole bunch of scientific analysis on those mummies. And, you know, working with certain collections that we have that, I'm like very excited about, and I get to investigate those and publish those. So it really is definitely a jack of all trades kind of a position, because you kind of have to, get into everything. But so it is a little bit of both of those things.
Nice. All right. Well, we've got a little bit shorter episode today for various technical reasons. So we're going to take our second break right now and come back and wrap up this discussion with Michelle in just a minute. Back in a second. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 71 with Dr. Michelle Koons. And Michelle, we talked a lot about museums, obviously, and what's going on and how you got into your job. But if somebody right now listening to this is either, I don't know, not an archaeologist at all or in some phase of their educational training and they want to go the museum route, what is some advice you can give them on getting into that job? Maybe some classes, focus some studies, or just knowing the right people. I don't know.
It's a great question. I actually get asked this all the time. Nice. And my biggest advice is to volunteer as much as possible at any kind of institution that'll take you, big, small, and in all capacities. So just getting to learn the museum world inside and out, because every museum's different, but there's so many different kinds of jobs in museums too, that it's just volunteering. It gets your foot in the door, even if it's a different institution. And that's what I look for all the time when I'm reviewing job applications.
Mm-hmm. And what about the future of the museum setting? We talked about this over on the Archaeotech podcast quite a bit. You know, with virtual reality and augmented reality and all these high-tech things coming out, I'm sure you guys are at least having those discussions. I know that's a big technological shift and probably an expensive one for a museum to undertake to do these sorts of things. But in your conversations about this, are you looking at other types of jobs that you might need to hire for? Like, you know, you might have to hire developers and people without archaeology degrees, things like that, to help along with these things. So how are those conversations going at your museum?
It's a really exciting time to be in the museum. I would say it's a large museum. There are 450 staff members here. Wow. So it's a very large institution. And as you can imagine, we have, a massive IT department and digital media departments and people that are really thinking about all these things. We're in the process, which is super cool. We are gutting our entire first floor and we're doing this whole new thing. We don't even know exactly what it's going to be. Calling it Future First, and they're going out and they're interviewing all kinds of community members to see what people are interested in, and we're gonna take it from there and really just use all these tools that are available now to kind of enhance experiences. Right now in one of those spaces, which is a temporary space, they have a whole VR arcade setup as an experience that you can come and do in the museum. And so I think that we're just going to see things get more and more exciting as this technology progresses. We're doing a lot more stuff outside in the communities, like no walls, stuff like Magic Mountain. So beyond the institutional walls, and just trying to be relevant for people in whatever ways we possibly can. And so I'm really excited with technology, where it will take us.
You know, someone you should probably talk to, we just interviewed them yesterday for the second time. The last time was about a year and a half ago, but it's called Lithodomos VR. And the gentleman who runs it, he's got a PhD in, I think, classical archaeology somehow. And they're based out of Australia, but they're doing basically virtual reality reconstructions of initially they're starting with a lot of, like, you know, big famous classical, you know, Roman type stuff and things like that in that part of the world. But they're also contracting with places like museums such as yours to maybe highlight specific sites, come over, do photogrammetry, and then create these applications where people can just, I mean, I use the, you know, practically free Google Cardboard and my iPhone, download one of their apps, and you can stand. I was standing on this Roman amphitheater in Croatia with a voiceover narration and sound and things like that. And it just really puts you into the spot. And it's just a really cool way to experience things like that. So, you know, just maybe I'll send you Simon's email and you guys can get in contact and he can see how you guys can help each other. That'd be cool.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, these are some of the things I would love to see in the future. I mean, of course, it's such a large institution. There's so many different things going on, but yeah, that would be amazing.
yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think it's really interesting. Museums, it seems to me, are both, we have this mindset that they can be very stodgy with these displays and research, but at the same time, they've really begun adopting technology in a way that, you know, I think academia and other archaeological research is still catching up on. I mean, you were just talking about the research and work you've been doing with the mummies and doing all the CT scanning and, you know, the way that museums have started approaching the analysis of collections is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it really is. And I mean, I think it's interesting not being in an academic institution because you have to be a little bit more creative in how you form some of your partnerships too. And so, for example, with the CT scanning, we were able to partner with the Children's Hospital and take the mummies there. And they got to go through the fun, like, jungle themed scanner where the kids go through. And just, you know, it's just, we have these different ways of getting to the same like results as you would as an academic, but we can be more creative, not like we are more creative, we can be more creative in maybe where funding comes from and where and who helps us with different things. And so I'm constantly learning and being like, I never even thought about doing it that way. And so I think it's an exciting place to be, to be able to experiment with pushing the envelope in certain ways.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Well, I'm curious, we've talked about some of the field work you've got coming up, some of the other things you're doing, but what's next for the Magic Mountain Community Archaeology Project, for the museum, for you? I mean, what are some of the big things coming down the line here that you're allowed to talk about right now?
Sure. So we're taking this year off from Magic Mountain Project just because we are still doing all of our analysis. You know, this is a community project, we are very, very, very keen to have great science come out of it and really great publications. And so we need some time to process all that. And so we're definitely taking this year off and we're going to evaluate what comes of it next, you know, because PCRG, who we're partnered with, we're both very committed to continuing to do these community archaeology projects. We're just not sure what that's going to look like. And so it's exciting. We're figuring it out. Yeah. So I there's just lots of things coming down the pike and you just kind of, I don't know. I'm not even sure yet. I'll get back from Peru and I'll figure some stuff out.
Nice. Well, if there's, is there anything else you want our listeners to know about the Denver Museum of Nature and Science? The DMNS, so to speak.
Mouthful.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know before we sign off today?
Well, definitely come visit us. We have, not only do we have tons of permanent exhibits, we also have two temporary exhibits at any given time. And we bring in like blockbuster shows that come from all over. What's actually really cool, I should add, in my job, we assign curators to those shows. And so the curators are responsible for having to learn and teach the content to our volunteers so that we're making sure we're doing the best we possibly can. And so right now we have a show on Leonardo da Vinci and one on senses. And so it's just constantly like fun new things are here. So if you're in the area, come visit.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show, Michelle. And I hope to get you on to talk about some of your other research and maybe some, you know, new exhibits and things like that that are coming down the line for the DMNS. And I hope everything goes well. And we'll talk to you again in the future.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.